This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Israel launches fresh missile strikes on Syria targeting positions in the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. Ukraine says Russian forces have made progress in the eastern city of Bakhmut, which is now the epicenter of the 13-month-long conflict. And also, China and Brazil strike a deal to use their national currencies in bilateral trade transactions, ditching the U.S. dollar as an intermediary. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Israel has carried out another missile strike on Syria, this time targeting positions in the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. The Syrian Defense Ministry says the early Thursday attack was carried out from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. It says two Syrian soldiers were injured as a result. Some material damage was caused as well. Syrian air defense has intercepted Israeli missiles and shot down some of them. Israel carries out frequent missile attacks on targets in Syria. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the UN Security Council, urging serious action against Tel Aviv's crimes. The calls have, however, fallen on deaf ears. Syria has vowed a crushing response to such acts of aggression in due time. Syria has reaffirmed its inalienable right to take back control of the occupied Golan Heights from Israel. Addressing a meeting of the UN Human Rights Council, the Syrian representative urged all countries not to recognize any steps taken by Israel to perpetuate its occupation of the Golan. Haidar Ali Ahmad described construction of settlements by Israel in the occupied Golan Heights as a war crime. He added that the move is a flagrant violation of Syrians' human rights. Israel's settlement construction activities in the Golan have increased since 2021, when the regime unveiled a plan to double the number of settlers there over a period of 5 years. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has held a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. The two sides discussed various issues of bilateral relations and exchanged views on regional and international agenda. Marina Kortanova has more.
Russia and Iran are in the final stage of finalizing a draft agreement on comprehensive partnership between the countries.
I am very grateful that the draft of comprehensive agreement on strategic partnership between our countries has been reviewed and finalized in Russia. We are now reviewing it again as well. I very much hope that within the next month, the legal departments of the foreign ministries of our two countries will finalize this draft.
The document is of strategic importance of solid, balanced new realities of bilateral cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. The treaty outlines the main guidelines for further building of the entire complex of Russian-Iranian relations for the coming decades. Among them is that Iran and Russia both agree that the JCPOA has no alternatives and needs to be implemented as soon as possible.
We talked about the situation around the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. We have a common understanding that there is no alternative to this international agreement, which was written down in the unanimously adopted UN Security Council Resolution 2231. We are in favor of the early resumption of the full implementation of this resolution and oppose actions that prevent this.
Lavrov said that the U.S. needs to lift sanctions against Iran and return to its obligations under JCPOA. The minister added that the West also seeks to neutralize China along with Russia.
Therefore, Russia, Iran, China, and many other countries will categorically oppose attempts to establish Western hegemony forever and ever, as Washington and its henchmen are trying to do.
Lavrov noted that Russia respects Iran's interests in a peaceful settlement of the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, for his part, pointed out that Western supplies of various weapons to Kyiv complicate the Ukraine conflict, which he said should only be settled via political means. Meanwhile, Russian-Iranian cooperation in the military technical sphere is carried out in accordance with Russia's international obligations. The parties have found an approach in all areas when it is possible to concentrate on coinciding interests and systematically build up economic cooperation as well. Russia has become the largest investor in Iran over the past fiscal year. Russia accounted for two-thirds of the total foreign direct investments in the Islamic Republic. The volume of Moscow's investments in Iran has reached $2.76 billion. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
The Ukrainian military says Russian forces have made some success in the eastern frontline city of Bakhmut, which is now an epicenter of the war between the two countries. Ukrainian military officials say, however, that their troops are still holding ground and repelling Russian attacks on Bakhmut. The city and surrounding towns in the eastern industrial region of Donetsk have been the focal point of assault for much of the 13-month-long conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Both sides have suffered heavy losses in recent weeks and have failed to take full control of the city. And in southern Ukraine, the International Atomic Energy Agency has reported a significant increase in the number of troops the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia power plant is located in the area. The UN nuclear watchdog has expressed pessimism about the protection of the plant. Britain's opposition Labour Party has barred its former leader Jeremy Corbyn from running as one of its candidates in the country's next parliamentary elections. A spokesman for the Labour said the party's governing body has approved a motion proposed by incumbent leader Keir Starmer not to endorse Corbyn. Opponents of the move have described Starmer's decision as a dark day for democracy. The UK's next election must be held by January 2025. Corbyn was suspended from Labour in 2020 for suggesting that complaints of anti-Semitism within the party during his leadership had been dramatically overstated for political reasons. His party membership was later reinstated, but Starmer refused to allow him to join the Parliamentary Labour Party. He currently sits as an independent lawmaker. In France, violent clashes have erupted between police and protesters angry at President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reform plan, which bypasses democratic norms. Despite mass demonstrations and calls for an end to the pension bill, the French government has clearly shown it won't back off from the plan, even if it has to use violent tactics to repress its own people.
Hundreds of thousands of people across France took part in protests and strikes to voice their discontent with Emmanuel Macron's use of constitutional executive powers to push through an unpopular raise of the pension age. Dubbed the Day of Action by French trade unions, Tuesday's protest was the 10th such mobilization since industrial action started in mid-January against the proposed reform, which includes raising retirement age from 62 to 64. A record number of security forces were also deployed across France amid fears of protests turning violent.
Faced with this situation, I have decided to deploy an unprecedented security force of 13,000 police officers and gendarmes, including 5,500 in Paris. 90 units of mobile forces will be deployed, a level of mobilization like never before.
As protesters staged generally peaceful marches across the country, violent clashes broke out in some areas, with security forces using indiscriminate force, including tear gas canisters and water cannons to suppress protesters calling for Macron's ouster. The crisis has intensified due to controversy over policing tactics, with lawyers complaining about arbitrary arrests, injuries, and extreme use of force during crowd control. Over 30 lawyers wrote an open letter to Le Monde on Monday, stating their great concern about what they called arbitrary arrests of hundreds of people. They accused the police of using the judicial system and arrests as a tactic to put people off protesting. Also on Saturday, Europe's leading human rights watchdog accused the French police of using excessive force against protesters. It said people angry at Macron's pension law had the right to protest peacefully and should have been protected from police brutality. The current protests are the most serious challenge to Macron since the Yellow Vest revolt 4 years ago. Polls show two-thirds of French people are against Macron's pension reform and the decision to push it through without a parliamentary vote.
China and Brazil have struck a deal to conduct trade transactions in their national currencies, ditching the U.S. dollar as an intermediary. The deal was announced by the Brazilian government. It enables the two countries to engage in direct trade and financial transactions using their own money. Brazil says the deal would reduce costs, promote greater bilateral trade, and facilitate investment. China is Brazil's biggest trading partner, with a record $150 billion in bilateral trade. Last year, the deal came after China and France agreed to conduct their first energy trade in the Chinese yuan. China has already reached similar currency deals with Russia, Pakistan, and several other countries. Iran has also moved to de-dollarize its foreign trade transactions over the past couple of years. Allies divided. That's how many analysts have described the recent war of words between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the latter's infamous judicial reforms plan. We've discussed this issue with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on his infamous judicial reforms has brought rifts between Washington and Tel Aviv to the fore. Now the U.S. President Joe Biden says that Netanyahu cannot go ahead with this controversial plan. Biden expressed hope that the Israeli Prime Minister would work out a genuine compromise over the reforms. Netanyahu has retorted to Biden's comments by saying the regime does not make decisions based on pressure from abroad, including from the, quote, best of friends. The rift comes as, according to an American official, Biden has not extended an invitation for Netanyahu to visit Washington later this year. Israeli cities have been the scene of mass protests over Netanyahu's proposed changes to the judicial system. After more than 12 consecutive weeks of protests, he backed down and said that he would hold talks with Knesset members over the matter. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joins us from Kitchener. We also have Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist, joining us from Houston, Texas. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Robert Fantina, let me ask you first regarding what Joe Biden has said and obviously what we know, or the whole world knows, of the reaction that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had, which in the three-part tweet that he made obviously a reference when he said best of friends to Joe Biden. Do you think that this is a minor rift or a major rift when it comes to the issue of these so-called judicial reforms?
Probably only a minor rift. The Israeli government has done many provocative things over the years that the United States has disagreed with and said they wished Israel wouldn't do, and Israel has simply ignored the situation. And the Israeli government believes it's going to be the case in this situation, too. Biden has known Netanyahu for decades, has basically supported all his crimes against humanity, his violations of international law. So this current rift, if we can call it that, is based partly on the fact that hundreds of thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets, and Biden wants Israel to remain a stable government so that it can do its bidding throughout the Middle East. So I don't think we're going to see any major action, such as a reduction of the amount of U.S. foreign aid that the U.S. gives to Israel each year. That's $4 billion a year, a little bit over that, I believe. And by cutting that off, even reducing it, Israeli government policies would immediately be changed. The U.S. government has never done that before, and it's unlikely Biden will do it.
When you take a look at the way that Mohsen Naqvi, the way that the U.S. president thinks about what he has now said in the soundbite that we just played, regarding these reforms and his stance on that, and also many U.S. lawmakers who agree with him, some are deducting that actually motivates Israelis to come out on the streets and to continue what they're doing, because at this point we're looking at just a pause, not for this to be scrapped. Isn't that one way of looking at the U.S. View and its particular, and in particular the U.S. president's view on this matter?
I think these current judicial reforms have been looked at from a very critical side from all intellectuals throughout the world. But I do think that the stance that Biden is taking in criticizing the new judicial reforms in Israel, there's an ulterior motive to that, and that is that he wants to play both sides of the coin. with the current protests that are happening, there's such a huge divide within Israel that, yes, as my counterpart had said, that Biden has had previous relations, very strong relations with Netanyahu. But Netanyahu, for all the wrong reasons, has partnered with people like Ben-Gavir. And these judicial reforms, the reason why they're being pushed is primarily because of the corruption case that stands against Benjamin Netanyahu. Any system of law, all systems of law, may that be presidential or prime minister systems of law, they all believe in the trichotomy of power where the legislation, the executive, and the judiciary need to be separated. Whereas these judicial reforms are affecting that very basic principle of constitutional law, in which unlimited power is being granted to the Knesset, and the judiciary is being blocked from having a judicial review. The Knesset, which is the parliament, has the power to override ruling by the Supreme Court if they deem that ruling unconstitutional. As far as U.S. law is concerned and as far as the U.K. law is concerned, this has been unprecedented. It has never been seen in any democracy of the world. So these judicial reforms, the reason why we see such protests in Israel is because it compromises the so-called democratic Zionist government in Israel. And Biden cannot afford to support these reforms. None of their partners can afford to support these reforms. So I personally think that Israel has been cornered. Netanyahu doesn't have a choice but to introduce these reforms, and Israel's partners don't have a choice but to take a stance against them. And this is the beginning of a rift between the Western Empire and Israel. And as Sayyid Nasrullah has said, that the only thing because of which Israel is surviving today in West Asia is because of its support from the Western Empire. As long as that support is finished, financial and military, there's no reason for Israel to exist. So that dream of Israel existing for more than 25 years, it's coming true a lot sooner than we had expected.
Thank you so much for that, Mohsen Nafi, human rights activist from Houston. Barbara Fantina, thank you, author and journalist there from Kushner. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Australians will head to the polls later this year for a referendum to decide whether Indigenous people should be recognized in the country's constitution. The government of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese also took the first formal step after introducing the Indigenous Referendum Bill to Parliament. It also sets up an Indigenous voice to Parliament to advise lawmakers on the views of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on matters that affect them. The referendum is expected between October and December. Aboriginal people make up just over 3% of Australia's population, but suffer from poor health, illiteracy, and unemployment. Every year, Australians mark the country's National Day with rallies in support of Indigenous people, calling it a day of invasion by British colonizers. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
On World Water Day, the international community must not forget Palestinians living under Israeli regime occupation, whose access to clean water is severely restricted. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to Middle East Eye, exacerbating Gaza's water problems is a wastewater treatment system battered by military strikes and fuel shortages. In 2006, missiles knocked out Gaza's only power plant. When the Zionist regime locked down the Gaza Strip the following year, its infrastructure was in dangerous despair. In March 2007, the embankment of a sewage reservoir collapsed, drowning 5 people. The Zionist regime's military offensives in 2008 to 2009, 2012, 2014, 2021, and August 2022 have killed over 4,000 people, including more than 870 children, and pulverized an already fragile infrastructure. Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009 damaged or destroyed 11 wells and 4 reservoirs, along with pumping stations, a sewage treatment plant, 19,920 meters of water pipes, 2,445 meters of sewage pipes, and sections of the electricity network vital for wastewater treatment. Operation Protective Edge in 2014 inflicted more damage on wells, water reservoirs, wastewater treatment plants, desalination plants, and pumping stations. During 11 days in May 2021, airstrikes affected 13 water wells, 3 desalination plants, and 250,000 meters of water pipes, reportedly including the main pipeline carrying water purchased from Mekorot. 3 days of strikes in early August 2022 resulted in some damage to sections of the water network, and a fuel shortage temporarily decreased water production and delivery by more than 50%. After each military assault, the Zionist regime's blockade has delayed the rebuilding process by months and even years, forcing Gazans to live with scant supplies of potable water and sewage flowing through the streets. In September 2014, the Zionist regime, the Palestinian Authority, and the UN set up a supposedly temporary Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism, GRM, to supervise the entry of construction materials while addressing the Zionist regime's security concerns. The GRM bureaucracy excluded dual-use items, meaning anything that could be put to military use by Hamas, including cement, wood, electromechanical equipment, and pipes. In 2017, there were 8,500 items on the dual-use list. Thousands of items not on the dual-use list still needed a special approval, bringing the economy to a standstill. By January 2022, the fabricated regime of Israel still had not permitted the entry of parts to repair the May 2021 wreckage of Gaza's water infrastructure. Further damage to the coastal aquifer was reportedly caused by the new 20-foot-high wall encircling the Gaza Strip, which penetrates deep into the ground to deter tunnel construction. By 2017, some 108,000 cubic meters of untreated sewage were being dumped into the Mediterranean every day. 5-year-old died after swimming in the polluted sea. The following year, Gaza was assessed to be on the brink of humanitarian collapse, given the acute energy, water, and sanitation problem, which poses severe threats to the public health. More than a quarter of diseases are water-related. Numerous reports point to nitrates from water pollution exceeding by 6 times WHO recommendations, causing a rise in cases of cyanosis. High chloride concentrations from seawater incursion into the coastal aquifer put pregnant women and children at a special risk, and contaminated water is the leading cause of child mortality. One study found that 59.2% of a sample of children had at least one parasite infection, and a similar percentage suffered from anemia. Cancer and kidney disease are increasingly common, with a 13% annual increase in patients suffering from renal failure. There have been outbreaks of communicable diseases such as acute hepatitis A, acute diarrhea, and typhoid fever. The lack of clean water makes it difficult to contain infections spread by multi-drug resistant organisms emerging from the widespread use of antibiotics to treat patients wounded in military strikes. Other health impacts are related to heavy metals from bombardments that stay in the soil, as the blockade prevents the removal where they contribute to the pollution of food and water supply. Researchers associated these toxins with an increase in birth defects in preterm and severely underweight babies and stunting of young children. Along with the crumbling health service and shortage of medical equipment, test kits, and vaccines, the scarcity of clean water has impeded efforts to ward off the COVID-19 pandemic. The International Committee of the Red Cross has denounced the Zionist regime's blockade as a form of collective punishment that violates international humanitarian law. Whatever the Zionist regime's justification for maintaining a closure clamped in place over 15 years ago to compel the population to overthrow the government, no security argument can annul the right of a population to water. Integral to public health and life itself, the human right to water, recognized by the UN General Assembly in 2010, is grounded in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Western regimes that have themselves been colonizing powers have little interest in enforcing international humanitarian law where the Zionist regime is concerned. They have ignored the damning assessment of the impact of the blockade and GRM issued by various NGOs. They have instead sought to apply technical solutions to avert the catastrophe facing Gaza's captive population without demanding an end to the blockade, and their pledges of aid have frequently failed to materialize. There have, after repeated delays, been some successes in the treatment of sewage, with the result that in July 2022, 65% of water along Gaza's coast was deemed safe enough for swimming. In 2020, World Bank-funded Northern Gaza Emergency Sewage Treatment Project finally opened near the site where 5 people perished in sewage in 2007. But the closure and collective punishment inflicted on Gaza mean that advances like these are fragile. Today, the temporary GRM has become an institutionalized part of an enduring arrangement that largely escapes criticism from donors who pay to rebuild what the Zionist regime has destroyed. Rather than pressuring the fabricated regime of Israel as the occupier regime, to respect the human rights of Palestinians, including the right to water, the international community has thrown money and technical expertise at a problem which calls for a political solution. In doing so, it is attempting to forestall calamity while acquiescing in Zionist regime's violations of international law. The Zionist regime now reportedly produces 20% more water than it needs, but that water is not being made available to water-starved Gaza, which is also barred from accessing West Bank aquifers. And without significant external pressure, things are unlikely to change. Genocide, wrote Ralph Lemkin, who coined the term, refers to a coordinated plan aimed at destruction of the essential foundations of the life of national groups so that these groups wither and die like plants that have suffered a blight. If that blight is to be averted in the Gaza Strip, the international community must immediately end its complicity in the collective punishment of the Palestinian people and pressure the Zionist regime to lift its blockade.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Since he took office 6 years ago, the French President Macron has hardly had a moment of plain sailing. First came the Yellow Vests, whose often violent protests against taxes and economic inequality rocked France for months, then the global pandemic, followed by the Ukraine war. Yet Macron has never been in as much trouble as in recent days. His decision on March 16th to force through a widely unpopular pension reform bill without a final vote by the National Assembly or the Parliament sparked one of the most serious crises in the history of France. In this edition of Spotlight, we will take a look at how these challenges have been testing the French government's commitment to human rights and how, to save his pension reform bill, Macron has lost France. To discuss that, we are joined by Mustafa Traoré, academic and political commentator who's joining us from Paris. And Don DeVar, activist and commentator, joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to Spotlight today on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Traoré. Now, over the last week in particular, we've seen protests breaking out almost every day, more than a million people taking part in these protests, and still Macron is insisting on following through with this pensions reform. Why is that?
I think there are different reasons to explain his position and his decision. is now in his second mandate, so he knows that he won't be elected anymore. So this is his last years as the French president, and he's got his political views, his political plans, and now is the best moment for him to put into practice, to implement all the laws, all the decisions he wants for France. Of course, many people are disappointed. Many people do not approve of the reform, especially because with this reform, the pension, the retirement age is going to be pushed to 64 instead of 62. And so it means two more years. And this is, of course, for when you started work at a very young age. But for those who started quite late, those who, for example, went to university and entered working life quite late, for them it's going to be 67. So he knows that now is the moment, and this is why he used this thing, which is part of the French constitution, the 49.3. So it is thanks to the 49.3, so which means that there were no debate. There was no debate in parliament. They did not vote. The MPs, the French MPs, did not vote, and he just passed the law. And he is doing and putting into place the policies of those who elected him. Those who elected him, those who put him in power. This is my opinion.
Well, thank you very much for that. Yeah, let's bring in Mr. Don DeBar from New York. Thank you very much, sir, for joining us. Now, two-thirds of the French oppose this law, and the approval rating of Macron is now at around 28%. It's really a dismal popularity rate, actually. And of course, France is one of those countries that prides itself as a role model of democracy. Democracy, as we say, the government of the people, by the people, for the people. And it seems that Macron is not even listening to these people.
Well, it's been interesting listening to Macron speak now, after listening to him lecture Iran and places all over the world on how to treat protesters. And we're hearing, I don't know what the reports are on the ground, but I'm hearing from news agencies and people that I know in Paris that, in fact, some of the police and fire officials have joined the protesters at this point. You know, if you look at the historical context here, I don't know if you want to go back to 1789, to the actual French Revolution, to the Paris Commune in 1871, or to Paris in 1968. And we're talking, these have always been really important in revolutionary history in the world. The terms right and left, for example, applied to politics, come out of the French Revolution in 1789. The historical context has always revolved around class issues, you know, create these divisions, basically the society is not providing for large sectors of the population who are being more and more immiserated, that produces these outcomes. Now, the particular thing here with the pensions is only, you know, one of a number of things that have happened over the last 40 years, with the pauperization of working people across Europe, with the austerity and the removal of the safety nets, etc. Looking across the globe, for example, Russia and China, those two horrible places for people to live. The retirement age is 55 for women and 60 for men. Somehow they managed to provide that. Here in the United States, even, I took retirement on Social Security age 62. French people have had, certainly since the 70s, a halfway decent and comparable situation. And it's one of the last things that have remained out of the, various things that were fought for and won over the last 150, 200 years. Macron is now taking that away. And the fact that it's happening in his second term and he's bypassing the legislature to do it should be a lesson to people looking at a second term for Joe Biden here in the United States, by the way.
Thank you very much. Now, Mr. Traoré, Celia Belin, who runs the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations, which is a think tank, says that there is a feeling that the president is not listening to his people at this moment, and the political legitimacy of Macron's second mandate is being called into question. What is your opinion?
Yes, I think this is perfectly right, but I think this is not new. There's nothing new in it. We know that President Macron never listened to the people. We saw it with the Yellow Vest movements 3 or 4 years ago, just before the COVID-19 crisis. So it is not something new. We know that he's done, and this is why he was elected. This is why some decided to have him in power. They prepared him as a candidate because they knew that with him, he was the only person who could, let's say, shape the French nation as they wanted to. And this is now, now we've got to. But it is it is something that the French people also accepted. They had the choice. They had the choice, even if many people say they did not have the choice. It was between Marine Le Pen and him. When I say he had the choice, I mean that there was a first round of the presidential elections. In the French presidential election, there was a first round. They did not pick up the right candidates. So now they have to accept it.
So, Mr. Debar, you did, of course, mention that Macron has been lecturing here and there other countries regarding the issue of human rights. Now France itself is actually using excessive force against these protesters who are mainly peaceful protesters. There are not that many reports of violence as far as the protests are concerned. And this actually raises a lot of question marks here, especially when we go back just a couple of months when Macron even held a meeting with people who were supporting the riots in Iran. He actually held a meeting, an official meeting, with these people who have no legitimacy and do not represent any Iranian group or party or political faction or any kind of group, as you can say. What is your opinion regarding that?
Yeah, there's no mass constituency for that at all. This is, you know, you have these attempted color revolutions that take place from time to time. You had a pair of them in Iran. I think it was 2009 was the earlier one. We had one in 5 years ago, for example, in Nicaragua. There was an attempted one there. There was one in Cuba over the last few years. And let's go back to the image of John McCain and Victoria Nuland and a host of other actual American government officials standing in front of a mob that was killing police officers and burning down buildings and exhorting them on to further, actually, ultimately, to overthrowing the government, with the demands from the outside that those people respect the rights of the protesters. This, you know, Macron was one of those voices, and his, and the members of his party, Sarkozy and others over the whatever period you want to talk about. And let's talk also about what happened in Libya and what they tried to do in Syria. Well, you know, this is something that's a common problem. And then finally, all right, in May of 2018, I marched with the Yellow Vests in Paris. And, you know, there were maybe 100,000 people that were out there. They were been mobilizing for years. Again, the context is a gradually intensifying, over a period of almost 4.5 decades now, austerity and increasing poverty and powerlessness that's been exacerbated over the last year and a half, by the way, by the consequences of a war in Ukraine that has both austerity because of the need to fund NATO and buy weapons and such, but also the fallout in terms of inflation and fuel prices and fertilizers and food and everything else. The people on the ground are hurting, and their governments are not responding. And what happened? Basically, when the powers who are governing can no longer govern in the old ways, and the people will not be governed in the old ways, they call that a revolutionary condition. And I'm looking at the history of France, and I'm looking at the fact that there was a problem over the condition of the people in 1789. There was a problem with the way that the military felt they were being treated in 1871, and then you had an illegal war in Vietnam that was being protested, and the response against protesters in 1968. You have all of those things operating now, and not much room to blow air back into the system. So this could be really catch fire. And these conditions exist across Europe now as well.
And do you believe that from now on, Macron can actually ever talk about democracy, ever, particularly on the international scale?
Well, not credibly. When people have no shame, they'll do anything, okay? And, you know, the Western political class has demonstrated over and over that they have no shame. But I don't know who would accept a lecture from him. Certainly no one in China, Russia, Iran, you know, and by the way, now Saudi Arabia as well, and around the world, that the territory that exists for the exclusion zone for the United States to banish people from has shrunken almost to the size of the United States at this point. There's a new world being born. It's actually being midwifed by the United States by forcing the rest of the world to do this.
Well, we will get back to that new world order that you just pointed out, but let's ask this question from Mr. Traoré now. Macron's legitimacy outside France is suffering as well. Our other guest from New York, Mr. Don DeBar, did point to a few issues. And also on Friday, a long-planned state visit to France by Britain's King Charles III was also postponed.
Yes, yes, of course. And I think it is a good thing for some African countries that are trying to emancipate themselves from the chains of France. Like I am thinking here of countries like Mali and Burkina Faso, because now Macron is in a weaker position. France won't be able to lecture them on some issues in Mali. So I think this is a good point for the emancipation of some African countries. So, in fact, what I think is that maybe Macron was a good president for the Africans because it is during his presidency that many countries are going, African countries have the possibility to set free from the French chains. So that's the positive thing, maybe.
Mr. Traoré, Macron himself claims that this was the ground of why he was re-elected. How do you think Macron will go down in history?
He will be seen as a liberal, and he came to shape France. He was the only candidate who was able to do it, to stand the pressure of the people, and this is why he was elected. I think that when you look at the French society, if you want to have an idea about what the French society is going to be like in 10 years or 20 years' time, you just have to look at the United States or Britain. Very liberal. And there's no way we can escape this one. I know it's not good, but there's no way we can escape this one. And the disappointing thing is that it seems that the French people have not realized it. If they had realized it earlier, they would have been better prepared. But now I think it's too late. I think the time to change things was when they had the Yellow Vest movement. It seems that this organization was not really respected. It was maybe because of the media as well. But the thing is that they missed the train.
So, Mr. Don DeBar, I would also like to have your response to this question as well, particularly in the light of what you just mentioned as a new world order emerging. How do you think France will be remembered in this new world order where the Western countries, Europe and the United States in particular, do not have the final say anymore?
Well, people are beginning to speak. I've noticed this over the last month or so, not just about the rise of the multipolar world and the new order, but they're looking also at the close of the colonial period that's lasted about 500 years, centered in Europe and the last 100 years or so also in North America. From that context, you know, you're looking again at sort of losing the domination of Western political thinking. I had mentioned earlier at the French Revolution, the terms left and right, for example, first were applied to politics. members of the National Assembly that sat to the left of the presiding chair of this assembly were the supporters of the revolution, opponents of the king, and the king supporters sat to the right. People have been grappling with the question of right and left right now since the fall of the Soviet Union, but particularly in the last couple of years, because so many of the issues that were identified with one side or the other in Western politics don't fit the current conditions. You have people that are against globalization and for example, war on Russia and China. Many of them identify as being of the right. And those who are opposed to, the global corporate economic behemoth also do so, many of them, from a perspective almost of Adam Smith rather than the various interpretations of Karl Marx. And so the whole period seems to be coming to an end, and a new world born, not just multipolar with respect to the traditional last period since World War II, but also truly post-colonial, where the centers of power rest with the people on the ground globally.
So, Mr. Traore, back to the issue of this whole pension reforms bill. You're still waiting in France for the Constitutional Council to pass this bill before it becomes law. How do you expect this to unfold?
I think that is going to pass for me. I do not see it being rejected. So I think that for me it's nice to demonstrate, it's not nice to protest, but I'm very skeptical about what's going to happen next. I think that it's too late. It's too late, unfortunately. And it is his second mandate. He's got no reason to step back. There's no reason for Macron to. He's got nothing to lose. So this is what we have to understand. The protest and the reason why people are demonstrating is just to for it not to happen again. But this time, it is too late. And I think that in a few weeks' time, you will have people who are going to, because business has to go on. Okay, you work, and if you do not work, you won't be paid. You have lots of people who are employees. Some have their businesses. So I do not see, it is too late. There's nothing we can do. It is past now. We have to be very vigilant for next time, because we know that today we have 2 years added to the retirement age, but we know that in 5 years' time, we might have one more year. Like people of my generation get to 67, the law will change, and they will ask me to go to 70 years old to retire. We all know this. Okay, so now they have to demonstrate, they have to protest, and they have to be more vigilant. Okay, and not get lost in very fake debates, as it was the case in the previous elections. In fact, if you look at these last 10 years, in all elections, we had fake debates about immigration, headscarf. No, these are not the real issue. The real issue was retirement. What do you want for France as a nation? Okay. So this is one fact. It is very sad, but I think the first people to blame are the French people, the French, those who voted. They had a choice, their choice between Mélenchon. Okay, no, they did not vote for Mélenchon. Okay, so now they have to accept it.
So, Mr. DeBar, Mr. Taroy did mention that Macron is at a point now where he really doesn't have much to lose. This is something that we've heard from a lot of pundits over the past couple of days. But as you mentioned so yourself, Macron does have a lot to lose still. He has France to lose, and of course the reputation of France as an advocate of democracy. So how do you think this will go down? How much do you agree with Mr. Taroy in order to wrap this up?
I would have a different focus. I think what we're seeing is the coming, growing irrelevance of the existing political structures to the lives of the people that live in France and elsewhere. And I think that what we're talking about here is a fundamental decision about allocation of resources inside the society, how much of it it's going to be set aside for the people that produce the value, the working people. I don't think they have any more room to give in terms of not having anything to lose. We're talking about, for Macron, his political career. For most people in France, in Paris, they're identifying with it, for example, they're talking about the very survival. You know, this past winter, there was the question of whether or not to have fuel or food. It's, if it's going to go up again another year or two, this and that, et cetera, things are going to get more intensive. You know, they become starker and starker choices. And there comes a point in time when the people decide that their own survival is more important than the forms of the existing government, and they toss it over. And the French have a tradition of doing that, and I think we're looking at the beginning of that now.
And do you agree with that, Mr. Taroy? A quick response.
I think that in terms of reputation, Macron does not care. And I think that this is the way the world goes. You know, if you look at every country, it's the same. Britain is the same. It is the decline of the West. This is what we have to admit. And there is a new order that is coming to life. This is what we see. So the American society, the British society, the French society, all the West is, for me, is about to collapse. And we are in it right now, and we have to accept it. There's a new order coming, and things are going to be different.
Things are going to be different, and Mr. Dandebar also agrees, I assume. We don't have much time left. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Mustafa Taroré, academic and political commentator from Paris, and Mr. Dandebar, activist and commentator from New York. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views on this edition of The Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadorbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali,
the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad.